welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Lib Dem blogger Mark Thompson, and also regularly featuring my co-host, Labour blogger Emma Burnell. Good afternoon, Emma.
Welcome to the Lion's Den, Mark.
And that is a reference to where we are, which is that we're down in Brighton at the Labour Party conference. I actually attended my first ever fringe meeting today at a Labour conference, which was very interesting. Brian Gould was there, actually, which was a nice little blast from the past. I remember him from many years ago, when I used to be interested in politics when I was a kid. And we're also joined today, we're delighted to say, by Rob Marchant, who is a Labour blogger. Hi, Rob.
Good evening, good afternoon.
It's still just about the afternoon.
Just about afternoon.
We're also delighted to be joined by Andy Harrop, who is General Secretary of the Fabians.
Hello.
Hello. And we're also delighted to be joined by Christine Quigley, who is a Labour activist.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, so I'm going to largely stand back on this one, just in case anyone's wondering when they listen to this why I didn't say very much, because it's Labour conference and it's only fair we allow the Labour people to have their say. So I'm basically just going to chair this week for a change, rather than get my all stuck in. So the first thing that we just wanted to talk about, I'll just let that motorbike go past, is just kind of general scene setting and how you think the Labour conference is going to go this week and what you think the important issues and debates are going to be. So, Rob, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is going to be the Labour conference about Ed Miliband doing the party reform process and or getting some kind of in-principle agreement for his party reform process, which I think, I mean, it's probably not putting too fine a point on it to say he's largely staked, you know, his leadership on the success of this programme. And I think if the programme were not to go forward, it would be, you know, that would leave him in a very difficult position. But the positive signs are, I think, that certainly that in the TUC conference a couple of weeks ago, I saw an awful lot of press, which I thought was very silly, saying that they thought he was rowing back on the proposals, when I actually saw completely the opposite. I thought he was very much standing up for what he thought. And I've seen a lot of interviews. I think Chuka Amuna did an interview the last couple of days, very much underlining exactly that there's no rowing back, that's going forward. And I've seen lots of things from lots of people saying that, you know, that this is really here to stay. So I think it's in very encouraging signs, because I'm personally very very much in favour of it. And in fact, I've just written a chapter of the Labour Uncut pamphlet, which is about to be launched tomorrow, which is about this very thing and why the party reform programme is so important to us.
Just for the benefit of anyone who isn't clear, can you just give us a kind of heads of terms of what you mean when you say the party reform agenda?
Well, the main points, if I can just remember them.
yeah, I'm putting you on the spot now, Rob.
It's about reforming the relationship between the party and trade unions, particularly about not having in future large donations going from unions to party. They'll be reduced to, I think it's a limit of, I can't remember what the limit is actually now.
Yeah. £5,000
is the proposal. Yeah. And also to change the way that unions interact with Labour Party institutions, such as the NEC, such as leadership elections, such as parliamentary selections. And one of the big cornerstones of the proposals is in the London mayoral elections, which are going to happen in 2016, to have a primary for those elections. So, I mean, it's a huge thing. It's a huge change for the Labour Party. And, you know, it's... For me, it's something that has just got to go ahead. But obviously, there is the potential, as there always is at conference, for trouble along the way. So we shall see.
I'm very supportive of the broad approach that Ed is taking on the reform of the party-union relationship. But I think it would be a real mistake for either the leadership or the unions to make a big deal of it this week. And there's a special conference early next year, and there'll have to be a lot of behind-the-scenes discussions in advance of that. But this really is Ed Miliband's once-a-year opportunity to have a showcase to the country. And although the reform of the party is important to show that we're a modern party that's reflecting what people all over the country want rather than just the interests of particular union leaders, that's not the top priority for this week. What we really need to do is show that we're gearing up towards the 2015 election, and particularly that we've got a lot more solid, credible policy than the Labour Party has been able to put on display over the last couple of years. And we're already beginning to see that happen with, you know, even before the conference started, a lot more policy announcements than this time last year. And I think we'll just continue to see that. You know, they need to, by the end of the week, have five or six real, you know, signature policies that people would actually have half a chance of remembering, and an activist could feel, you know, a bit more fired up about, you know, talking on the doorstep when they're, you know, knocking on doors, phoning people up. You can answer the basic question, what's the Labour Party for, and how would it be different from the coalition?
Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that this is going to be the demystifying conference. I think over the last couple of years of the policy review, there's been a lot of think tanks, sorry Andy, there's been a lot of academics.
And me.
And there's been a lot of jargon.
And there seems to have been a lot of reports as well, from an outsider's perspective.
There's an awful lot of reports, but I'm really hoping that what we're going to start seeing from this conference are some actual coherent policies, and effectively the start of the pledge card that activists are going to sell in on the doorstep over the next couple of years. I think both in general, I think the general public are very interested in finding out what's One Nation Labour actually about, not in terms of pre-distribution, but in terms of the money in people's pockets. And I think for activists, similarly important, you know, we have to go out and sell these policies on the doorstep, and we have got an election in 8 months' time. We've got the local and the European elections. And I think it's going to be very important that Labour articulates a really strong vision in those elections. So I'm really hoping that we see some great concrete proposals of the kind that we've seen over the last couple of days. So I'm really excited about Ed's speech.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have got some really interesting concrete proposals. I think if one were to criticise the way that we've behaved so far, sometimes we get a little bit too academic. And
Emma's looking at me at that point.
I was not, but you know, if the cap fits. I've just joined the think tank world, so I'm very in favour of think tankery. But I think
is that a word?
Yeah.
It is in the wonkery world.
It shouldn't be. It really shouldn't be.
But I think it is sometimes the case that we've had these ideas that are interesting and important, but we haven't translated them into your very basic doorstep promise. And actually, some of the ideas that are coming out, have come out in advance of this conference, are actually clever ways of dealing with real tensions in the Labour Party. So, for example, the an apprentice for an immigrant idea actually is a really great way of dealing with the immigration issue and the pressure that that puts on jobs, particularly for young people, whilst at the same time making that a very clear promise. And something that will fix the long-term problem of the skills gap whilst also being able to literally say it in a sentence. And I think that we've started to stop our cleverness remaining internal and started focusing that messaging of outside, and I think that's really important. And also, we've pledged to repeal the bedroom tax, about which I did a little dance of joy.
But on immigration, I mean, partly as a first-generation immigrant myself, I'm concerned that we're still not actually articulating the positive case for it. And we're still, I think this policy is going to be very interesting, but I think we're still pandering to the right on it. And we see with the Conservatives attacking right on immigration, they lose ground to UKIP. I think that the Labour Party will lose ground unless it starts talking about immigration and the benefits it brings, as well as the issues that come because of it.
I think it's really, really difficult. Immigration is one of those issues that Labour Party members feel really strongly and passionately about.
Some of us are immigrants.
Indeed, and some of us are the descendants of immigrants.
Or married to immigrants.
And we are not necessarily, because it's something we care about so deeply, we don't necessarily find it easy to have the conversation with people who feel differently from us or have strongly held but not necessarily well informed beliefs, your beliefs based on the facts rather than the front page.
I think it's also, Emma, an area where your previous point about being a bit too academic and wonky rather than, you know, sort of focused on what people will engage with in an ordinary conversation is a real problem, because Ed Miliband has talked a lot about how he wants to reform the labour market so it's not exploitative for either Indigenous workers or immigrants, which works incredibly well in a seminar room. But actually, how do you translate that into people who are quite understandably fearful about, you know, their jobs and their kids' jobs, and, you know, see, let's face it, an awful lot of recent immigrants at a time of high unemployment? It's not surprising that this is a concern for people. The problem with immigration, and there are a couple of other areas like it, Social Security being a good example, is that the party is not united. The conversation within the party has not come to a conclusion.
No.
A lot of the other policy announcements we'll see this week, there's a lot more consensus, and therefore it's easy to project, you know, to the country what we want to do.
But I do think that this particular announcement, particularly on the high-skilled non-EU migration, and, you know, saying this is not a no more immigration, it's saying for everybody who does come in, who fills a necessary and important role now, we also are training up the next generation who live here. And I think in some ways that's a very clever way of tying up those two sides of the party into something that they could probably meet on the middle ground on. And I think that's what's clever about this policy, whilst also it's something that we can sell on a doorstep. So, I mean, I hadn't thought of it. I thought it was really quite impressive way of bringing those three points of that triangle together and actually finding some middle ground.
Immigration is also an area where Labour can reach out to the business community and show that it is, you know, it's about, you know, pro-enterprise and growth. And Europe policy is another area where actually Labour's position is probably closer to a lot of, you know, sort of pragmatic business interests and the environment agenda too. So although reaching out to the voters is the most important priority, being seen to be credible with business is going to be very, very important for the next year.
Yeah, that, my just thought on immigration, the concern I have about the debate that's going on at the moment in the Labour Party and elsewhere is people don't seem to be distinguishing between, on the one hand, legal immigration intra-EU, which people have a perfect right to do through EU law, and illegal immigration from outside the EU, which is obviously illegal. And actually, the problems that most people, I think, in the country have with immigration are the legal immigrants who are putting strain on public services, because, you know, we couldn't cope with them, and, you know, through the Gordon Brown years we had, you know, the opportunity to kind of slow that down, and we didn't, and we're now playing catch up. So I don't know, my worry is that we're kind of mixing in lots of really quite different subjects and talking about immigration as if it were one kind of homogeneous thing, and it's just not.
And Labour has to have the courage to take on some of these issues where the coalition is sort of conflating a lot of different things. So particularly where it comes to the high skills and, you know, young people coming as students, they're being restricted a lot, and actually they don't have any link to a lot of the anxieties people have. It's just been a catch-all policy.
And equally, the go-home vans and the campaign that was run alongside it that just randomly stopped. Well, when I say randomly, I think people of a certain appearance were stopped at tube stations throughout London. That had nothing, you know, you weren't stopped because they had knowledge that you might be an illegal immigrant. You were stopped because they were stopping a certain amount of people in case they could scare off enough people. And it was very much about a fear campaign.
I think I would have had less of a problem with the go-home bans if I thought that at any point I might have been stopped as an immigrant and asked to see my papers. But I think what that did was it actually galvanised whole sections of the community who may have been second or third generation immigrants, and maybe EU migrants like myself, who actually don't see a huge difference between the way we're treated and the way other people are treated, and who are quite concerned about it. And I'm conscious I'm speaking from quite a London point of view. I live in Lambeth, which is a very ethnically diverse borough, but people did get quite angry about it, and I think it was something that backfired.
Yeah, I mean, my brother is black, and he's actually an immigrant. He lives over in Australia. But I remember him saying once that when he goes to restaurants with my mother, who is white, or my father, who's white, my brother is adopted, before anyone thinks it's strange genetic, that in London, nobody blinks an eyelid, because it's a complete, you know, everybody in London has different relations of different kinds. But when they moved out to Hertfordshire, he felt like everyone was staring at him, and he felt like that was a judgmental thing. And I was really reminded of that by the go-home vans, and I felt like those vans were there to make people feel like my brother had felt at that point. My brother, who was born in this country, who is a British citizen, working towards Australian citizenship now. And that was just a horrible, horrible feeling that Michael felt so judged as separate from his own family. Not by his own family, I hasten to add. And that, you know, that really, really kicked home to me when I saw those vans, and it just was so horrific.
Yeah. I mean, from a Lib Dem perspective, I think Nick Clegg himself said in his speech last week that, had we been asked, we'd have had a problem with it, which I think probably says a little bit about what's going on within the coalition. Okay, maybe if we can move on from immigration. So another thing that we wanted to talk about today was cost of living, which I think is going to be quite an important theme of Labour conference. And certainly, judging by some of the things that senior Labour ministers have been saying, that certainly seems to be the line of attack now, with the coalition proclaiming that, George Osborne implying or even stating we've turned the corner, although very careful not to use the term green shoots, having learned the Lamont lesson of many years ago. What do we think about that, Andy?
This is starting from how people are feeling, but it's also starting from where is the Labour Party still strong in the public's mind. So although lots of the polling on Labour is pretty dire, two things that people still say positively about Labour is that they've got, they're on my side, and I might feel personally better off under Labour, even if I don't trust them on the wider economy.
Just as a brief aside, because I keep hearing this about, Labour's doing terribly. Labour's ahead in the polls in almost every poll. I mean, if there was a general election tomorrow and these polls are correct, Labour would have a majority of 70 or 80. What is it that you're so worried about?
There's a big difference between the sort of the attributes of the Labour Party and Obed Miliband personally, which poll badly, versus the overall position in the polls. And actually, I'm not as negative as some people. I think that the travails of the Lib Dems, which you know all about, are actually very structurally significant for a realignment of centre-left voters. So there aren't that many more centre-left voters out there, but the fact that some of them have pivoted to Labour from the Lib Dems gives Labour, it starts with the election campaign, quite close to being a majority party if it can get those Lib Dem switchers to vote. It's then got to reach out to other groups to make sure it does become a majority party, and it will be difficult. It needs to reach out to a lot of people who have given up on politics, who have just stopped voting recently, usually people who were once Labour voters.
So do you think this cost of living argument is going to cut through to those voters?
Yes, it will. It will cut through to people who are sort of, who don't see the point of politics. You know, what difference can a politician can make? You've got to get very practical, money in your pocket, or better public services, as we heard with the announcement on wraparound childcare around schools. The big challenge is cynicism. So you can say all of this, but we've got this point where a lot of people who just don't believe or listen to what politicians say. So it's going to be more than just a single conference week of announcements before you can start cutting through to people who have given up on politics.
Yeah, I think it's the classic one, isn't it? It's only once politicians have said something 1,000 times and bored themselves and all their supporters rigid that Joe blogs in the street even aware that that's a campaign. That's
right. The interesting thing about sort of Labour's electoral position is that it needs to bring over those people who have given up on politics, and actually quite a lot of young people who have never voted so far. It doesn't need to bring over so many Conservative voters. We've got this curious position where it's basically trench warfare between the broad left and the broad right. Very few people are shifting their sort of allegiance between the two camps. It's much more about people deciding to vote or not, and deciding whether they vote Lib Dem and Labour on the one hand, and Tory and UKIP on the other, and that combination will decide who wins.
But isn't that because we're not actually reaching out to the centre ground and convincing people? I mean, I don't know, to say we accept the fact that they're in two camps and we're not going to try and convince people in the centre, I don't know, so it seems to me a bit, if we adopt that position, then it's a bit of a defeatist position, because it says, let's leave those votes in the centre, and it could well be that Cameron, near the election, picks them up, and that's a danger for us, I think.
Well, you have to start where you are from. Where do you start from? Even at really good points in this Parliament, when Labour's been at 44% in the polls, it's still only taken a handful of Conservative votes. It's all the support has come from other places. Now, I mean, you might be right, Rob, as to sort of how you would start from, you know, start from scratch, blank sheet of paper. But we've got the Labour Party today.
Not doing that again.
We've got the Leader today. let's win the best way we can with this combination.
Of the 5 million votes that Labour lost between 1997 and 2010, we talk about, in fact, 1 million of them went to the Lib Dems, but 2 million of those people died. So we have to look at engaging with new voters. It's incredibly important, which is why I think Vote to 16 is quite a good idea, because I think it gets people into the habit early of thinking about voting. It's going to be incredibly important to reach out to younger people. I think that the cost of living argument works particularly well with a couple of groups of people that I've been talking to on the doorstep who feel quite disillusioned with the Labour Party. So I've spoken to a lot of women in their 30s with families who voted Conservative last time around because they felt that Labour didn't have sensible policies on children and childcare. I think actually, to be fair to them, the Lib Dems have been very good on childcare during this government. I think the Labour Party has got to try and regain some of that ground, which I think it will. The other area where I think it works quite well is on small businesses, who I think traditionally have felt that the Conservatives are more on their side. When I talk to small business owners, they're actually excited about some of what Labour is talking about and some of the support for small businesses, particularly around taking on apprentices and around minimum wage.
This is something that Mark and I have talked about before. I think Labour's got a real opportunity to be the party of small business now.
Definitely going in the market.
Yeah, the Tories have moved so fast towards being the party of, if a business is small, it's because it's a hedge fund and only has five incredibly rich people working for it. But yeah, the narrowing of things like corporation tax, so that small businesses are taxed almost at the same rate as a multinational corporation, it's just insane. And I think there is a real... I'm speaking tomorrow at a fringe for BPAS on the politics of motherhood. One of the things I want to talk about is possibly Labour having something like a government-backed maternity leave insurance, which you pay alongside national insurance. Because one of the things that my mum has said with her small business is that she's got someone on maternity leave at the moment. She is a good employer. She's a living wage employer. She wants to have the best possible maternity cover so that she has good relations with her employees. But it keeps her up at night that one of her other employees might get pregnant and the business could go under. But if she had a government-backed maternity cover insurance, that would actually really, really help her plan and be secure in her business and to properly employ in her... You know, I don't think she actually has on her staff of six at the moment any men. But so she's never chosen her employees based on this. But there are plenty of people who are, you know, really worried and might be making employment decisions based on whether the young women in their 20s and 30s of their employment might...
I think it's absolutely... I mean, it's a really important point. I worked in a business in the early 90s, which is a firm of about 100 people. And the employers at that time were actually quite, you know, forward-thinking. There was pretty much... I mean, it was about pretty much 50-50 workforce. And then the boss got quite upset because about... I don't know, something like... 12 women all went off at the same time, and he was just like, I've been being good and trying to be, you know, equality minded, and look what's happened to me. So I think it's a massive thing. It's a kind of a hole that hasn't been plugged since then, which I think is bizarre, really, because it's, you know, it's an ongoing problem.
So that's something that I will be promoting to the party to see if they take up. And I think it's not about, you know, it's not a policy that should cost money, because that's, you know, insurance works by paying in and then taking out when it's needed. But hopefully it would be it's fiscally responsible as well as helpful to small business. But I think there are so many different ways that we could make being a small business person less risky, and then they are better able to spread that lack of risk through making decisions that benefit their communities. And I think that's an extraordinary place that Labour can go that the Tories don't seem to have any interest in being.
Okay, so maybe we'll move on to the next question, which I've got on my list here, which is we could probably entitle We Need to Talk About Damien. for anyone who's been living on Mars, Damien McBride, who used to be one of Gordon Brown's troubleshooters, agitators, I don't quite know what name you'd want to put on him, basically a backroom person who briefed the media.
Backstabbing
person is probably much more accurate. I mean, it's been all over the papers in the last couple of days. He's written a memoir, which is coming out, I think, on Wednesday. And basically it seems to be spilling the beans on a lot of behind the scenes stuff that happened in Gordon Brown's office, both when he was Chancellor and also when he was Prime Minister. Christine, what are your thoughts about this? Do you think this is will all be over in a few days and everyone will have forgotten about it?
To be honest, I don't think anybody who isn't already listening to this podcast cares at all what Damien McBride did.
I think you're overestimating our listenership. but carry on.
No, honestly, I think it's one of those stories that causes a bit of eruption in Westminster and Whitehall, but doesn't permeate to the country. We have to remember that most people really hate politicians, just all politicians. They're definitely in there in the kind of the pantheon with the state agents and bankers and whoever else is
playing journalists.
Exactly. So I don't think the revelations that somebody, when they were in government, did some quite unpleasant things is going to be much of a shocker for anybody who actually reads a newspaper.
But it almost sounds like you're saying they're all sort of at it and this was really no different to what's always been going on. Do you not think there's something particularly egregious about some of the stuff that's come out about McBride? The fact that he seems to have forced John Reid to resign for stuff he did 20 years before he was ever a minister. And there's some pretty horrible things that are coming out here, and I think there's still more to come.
I mean, do I think Damien McBride is a deeply unpleasant man? He probably is. I don't know him, but I'm not sure I would want to go and have a drink with them after reading some of the stuff in the papers. But I just don't think it's going to permeate into the national consciousness. I think when people read the newspapers for what's happening at Labour Party conference, they will actually be interested in what's the Labour Party going to do for me. Yeah. And they will be interested in the economy and in housing.
And I also think, I mean, they might, you know, various people might make various criticisms of Ed Miliband, but the one thing you can say about him, he's absolutely clearly not running that kind of operation.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, he's a nice guy. Yeah. And he doesn't come across as that whole kind of netherworld of Brownite politics that happened.
He was a very close advisor to Brown, as was Ed Balls, actually, whilst all this was going on. So, I mean, although I don't think there's been any smoking gun to directly link him to any of this stuff, he was kind of part of the team. He must have known it was going on.
But even Blairite's lights in, then they call him the ambassador from Planet Fuck or something.
Yeah, he was called that. He was the only acceptable member of the Brown team because he didn't do this sort of stuff. And he was on Andrew Marr this morning and, you know, made a joke of the fact that no one had ever called him macho. And, you know, this may be another, you know, sort of difficulty for him in a different way. But actually, maybe these sorts of revelations, you know, there's nothing really new. We knew that the Brown-Blair teams hated each other and on both sides behaved pretty despicably. There's a contrast here with how Ed does politics. I don't want to overplay it, but it does show that he is a different sort of guy and, you know, doesn't want to behave quite as badly as, you know, a lot of the recent New Labour figures allowed their teams to.
I mean, one thing I would say in terms of, I think Christine's absolutely right that these incidents, this story isn't going to permeate. What it does do, though, is tell people that politics is an unpleasant, macho, big dick swinging, horrible place to work, and that can put people who aren't macho, big dick swingers off coming to be active in politics. And I think it's really important that we not only are different, but show ourselves to be different and to be open to being better and closed to being that bad ever again. Because I think that we won't get the best talents of all the best people that we could be working with if we don't do that.
Yeah. And one thing that strikes you as you go round the three-party conferences is that there is a real cultural difference between the three political parties. And I think the Labour Party has changed over the last 10, 15 years. There are just a lot more women involved in quite senior levels of politics. Not enough, but, you know, look around this conference and it is a different atmosphere from a decade ago.
Absolutely.
So, the feeling from around the table seems to be this is largely a non-story.
It's a fun story, but it's not a story that's going to change politics. The politics has already changed. It's changing beyond making sure that change stays permanent, but it's not today's story, it's 3 years ago, 4 years ago's story.
I think it's a Westminster bubble story, and people don't really give a damn who Damien McBride is outside the Westminster bubble.
I think Damien McBride would be a pointless answer. And I think that, you know, if you asked, you know, name a government spin doctor, Damien McBride on pointless would be a pointless answer, and I think that's kind of how you've got to measure these things.
there's a slight reek of desperation around it, actually. It's this kind of desperate attempt to pull Ed Miliband back to the sort of last days of the
Daily Mail.
So, you know, and it just comes across as a little bit sad.
That all you got?
I doubt we're going to be seeing Damien at party conference this year.
I haven't spotted him so far, but I'll keep an eye out for him.
I wouldn't even know what he looks like.
Oh, yeah, I've seen some rather ruddy-cheeked pictures of him.
I couldn't pick him out of a lineup of other ruddy-cheeked Labour patch apparatchiks.
What I have seen, actually, since I've been here... See, I'll just allow the cutlery to finish.
We should tell people we are recording this in a restaurant.
If it isn't obvious, we're in a restaurant. That's why there's a lot of extraneous background noise. Yeah, what I have noticed at this conference is on lots of street corners, lots of earnest-looking young men in suits, which is quite interesting, handing out flyers. So I think you can tell that there's some kind of conference in town.
They're the same guys that go to your conference, it's just that they wear their sandals when they're there.
Well, yeah, with the bowls of muesli. Yeah. Another thing that I want to talk about is the whole question of full employment, because the first and so far only fringe event that I have attended here was run by the Fabians, and Andy actually introduced it, and it had Brian Gould, Liam Byrne, and then a couple of other people whose names escape me, I'm afraid. I'm sorry, one union person. A
couple of union people.
Yes, in fact, two union people. And Brian Gould went on and on and on. I think he was indulged a little bit by the chair because he's an elder statesman. But I think he made some good points. But it was all about full employment. And I have to say, I mean, I was on Twitter and there was quite a lot of scepticism about this idea that you could achieve full employment. And then someone did tweet, well, but full employment doesn't really mean full employment, does it? It's a kind of technical term. And I kind of said, well, that's part of the point, isn't it? I mean, Andy, do you think this is a vote winner? Or do you not think people will just be so cynical as to think, come on, full employment, that's never going to happen, and therefore not believe it?
Well, part of the story of this recession has been the labour market's performed much better than people expected, which is a pretty harsh thing to say when you've got a million young people unemployed. But actually, compare us to, you know, Spain or any other number of European countries, actually things have gone quite well, particularly for people over 25. And the reason for that, in my view, is a lot of the labour market reforms that the Labour Party put in train over 13 years. You've got far fewer people out of work long term, you know, in workers' households than you did a decade or so ago. Of course, politicians would never talk about the labour market in that way, because for every person who is affected out of work, it's incredibly difficult, you know, soul-destroying experience to face. But if you look forward, I think when the economy starts to pick up, the underlying, you know, structural labour market is better in the UK than a lot of European countries. And actually, we might finally start to see some progress. And Labour needs to have a positive offer of how it helps people at the margins of the labour market be sort of, if you like, more attractive to employers. Because the alternative is we'll have lots more migration, because employers will want to hire people. This may still be 4 or 5 years down the line, but there will be demand for jobs. And if people in Britain can't meet that demand, as happened in the mid-2000s, then we'll be back to where we started. So it's all about giving people the skills and confidence and capability to match the jobs that will sooner or later become available.
Christine, what do you think?
Full employment is one of those terms that really resonates with people within the Labour Party. And I think particularly amongst people who'd see ourselves as a bit old Labour, a bit kind of 1945, setting up the NHS type of Labour. And it's great, it sounds brilliant, but I think it's going to be a lot more complicated than when we talked about it back in 1945, when full employment meant every man in the workplace with a wife and children at home. And we've got a very different economy now. And I think it's going to be much more challenging to do that. We're going to have to see a real fundamental shift in how our economy works. And there's some really big questions that need to be asked. So if we're pushing for full employment, how do we take account of the role of caring, particularly when we've got such an ageing society? And those sandwich generations of people who are caring both for parents and for grandchildren. How do we encourage more women back into the workplace? And how, again, as we were talking earlier, how do we support employers to be more flexible around it? Because we're not talking about 9-to-5 jobs here. We're not talking about manual work in the way we would have 60 years ago. So I think it's a fantastic aspiration. But I'm really looking forward to seeing some of the detail of how it's actually going to work.
This is the other problem as well, isn't there? Because would you count 0-hour jobs in the employment figures?
Well, we shall see whether we still have zero-hour
jobs. We're going to
abolish
them.
No, we're going to abolish the exploitation of zero-hours contracts.
I have someone who did work a zero-hour contract once. It does actually work in some circumstances. Right. When I was a student, I was a permanently zero-hour employee of a fundraising company. And what that meant was I didn't work in term time, and when I came home, I had a job in my holidays permanently.
But there are
good 0 hours contracts. It's just that most of the ones we've got now are not them.
But the main problem I have with 0 hour contracts is that you're forced, in some cases, to not be able to have a contract with anyone else.
Yeah.
So they might give you work, they might not, but you're not allowed to go anywhere else. Was that how your job was?
Not in the slightest. No, I had a job at university in Possum's restaurant.
Right. Yeah. I have two kind of thoughts on the whole full employment thing. One is, I think, the scepticism that I think people have been showing the last few days. Labour, what are they talking about? They can't do full employment. I mean, we may not have had absolutely perfect 100% full employment, but we came pretty damn close.
Yeah, yeah.
We came pretty damn close during our time in government, and it lasted quite a long time. And people during the Tory years, during 18 years, were saying, full employment, I mean, that's an unachievable, that's pie in the sky, that will never happen. And they were wrong, and we did it. And the idea that people can say, Labour are, you know, that's pie in the sky, we're never going to do it, it's wrong. We can do it, and we will do it. But the second thing is, unfortunately, what of course is different now is the economic circumstances have massively changed. And to make it an aspiration, I think absolutely should be an aspiration, but we are going to be so much more constrained about what we can actually do to invest in the economy to create jobs and to use up that capacity, then it's going to be much more difficult. So we've got to be very careful about what we promise so that we don't overpromise and then
which levers we can and can't pull.
Exactly. So I think it's right as an aspiration, but we need to manage expectations and say, look, this is not going to happen on, you know, after a couple of years. This is going to happen after a 5-year or a 10-year programme that of us in government. But at least for us, it's an aspiration. For the Tories, it's not even an aspiration.
And also, I mean, the thing about these targets, take the child poverty target that we had under the last government. We didn't achieve it completely, but my God, we came a long way. Unfortunately, it's fallen back considerably under this government. But, you know, having those targets and making them part of our aspiration, what we need to do is do a combination of having these aspirations and trying our goddamnedest to achieve them, which is what we did with child poverty under the last government and full employment and getting damn close, but also embedding whatever it is that we're doing so that it cannot be dismantled quite so easily.
It's also a really good test if you say full employment is one of the most important things we'll think about for any policy, then you have to decide, you know, rank which policies are going to be more effective. We know we'll have very little money, so we need bang for buck. So you pick the two or three things that would have the biggest impact early on. So, for example, you know, helping more women work, you know, the way universal credit is being set up, it just isn't worth mothers with kids in childcare to work. That's absolutely mad. You know, that's just a waste of the economy. And there are relatively affordable ways you could sort out social security and childcare, and that would have a huge employment benefit. Might even pay for itself if enough people were then able to work.
Okay, so just before we wrap up then, has anyone got any final thoughts on how things are going to go in the next few days? And maybe, because we only really do these specials once a year, what you think's maybe going to happen over the next year or so? Rob, do you want to give us your thoughts?
Wow. What's going to happen over the next few days? Well, I hope it's going to be a fantastic leader speech, which is going to explain exactly why not just a whole raft, hopefully, of solid manifesto policies, but explain to people and win the day on the party reform programme. Because I think, even though, except what Andrew was saying about it, it shouldn't necessarily be a priority in this week, but I think it's going to be one inevitably. I think people are going to want to talk about it. They're not going to want it to kind of pushed under the carpet. So I think.
Do you think that, because it sounds like it's a special conference where this is going to
in spring?
Yeah. Do you think he'll get it through?
I think he will, because he has to.
Yeah. Is it going to be put to a vote of all the members?
I don't know what the mechanism
is. Arguably he should have gone down that line, but actually it's going to be put to the conference, which is half delegates from constituencies and half from unions, which is probably a harder test than having put it to the whole of the membership. So I agree with Rob that this is going to be a critical issue over the next year. It's just whether it plays out in the week ahead.
Well, maybe they'll try and play it down this week, but I have a feeling it's going to kind of spring back out of the box, whether they like it or not.
And it's actually a real challenge for Ed, because he's got to find a position where he appears to win, because he can't be seen to be in the union's pocket, but also keeps that relationship on track. And finding that, you know, sort of middle way, Goldilocks point is
third
going to be
way.
Very difficult.
I like the third way.
The
much
other thing, so that will be my first big thing in the year ahead. The second is the implications of the economy turning, if it indeed is. So that's obviously, you know, put the Conservatives on the front foot, wait and see what happens next week. But it's also incredibly challenging for Labour, having been so critical of the coalition's economic performance. It's got to pivot on how it talks about the economy and not be seen just as a party of bad news. It needs to have a really credible message of how it would use any, you know, sort of benefits of economic growth that appear, and also be the party that would sustain long-term and broad-based growth rather than just be seen to be talking down the economy.
So you think there's a real danger that if Labour isn't careful, it could be perceived as the party that's talking the economy down? Because I think you're right. I think George Osborne will pounce on anything that could be construed like that very, very quickly.
I know that Ed Balls is alive to this, that in a, he recognises he needs to move on from the way he's positioned his economic message over the last 2 years.
Christine, what do you think?
I think this is going to be a real game changer these next few days, because what it's really about, this conference, is changing the internal dialogue that Labour has been having for the last year and a half of the policy review into something that's external facing ahead of the next set of local elections next year, which are going to be very important for Labour. I think there are going to be a couple of themes that will come out. Obviously, the cost of living is going to be front and centre. I think Labour putting real effort into re-establishing the party as the party of the NHS, because it's, you know, it's one of those core issues that, you know, people always trust Labour more on the NHS. I think that's going to come out much more strongly over the next year or so. And I think housing is going to be a really big issue as well. We're starting to see in all three parties there are conversations now about the fact that we've got a huge housing gap across the country. It's a real issue in London, it's also a real issue in rural areas where people are being forced out. And the fact that Jack Dromey, I think, is speaking at 17 Fringes on housing over the next couple of days shows just how much housing is an incredibly important issue for the Labour Party. And I'm hoping that we see some quite exciting announcements on that.
Okay, Emma?
Yeah, to echo what Christina said, housing, as you know, is my theme in life. Housing, women! It kind of sums up my politics. But I think it's...
Do you have to say women in a high voice, just so I get it right next time?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
It's kind of Monty Python style.
Very Monty Python style, yeah, absolutely. Sorry. But I think, someone who is experiencing firsthand the fact that we are in an insane housing bubble at the moment, and quite possibly that's what's driving a lot of the current uptick in the economy, whether that bubble is going to burst over the next year is quite worrying. I don't think we have a growth that is currently sustainable, and people like me are massively benefiting from the real difficulty that anybody who isn't currently in the housing market, and I spoke to my downstairs neighbours about I'm selling my house, and I spoke to them and she just looked at me and said, I'm completely fucked, I will not ever own a house. And I couldn't think of anything to say to her other than, yeah, I'm really sorry, I'm afraid I think you are. So we don't have anything like a sustainable economy for the next generation, and I think that's going to, I don't know whether that's going to explode in the next year or the next 5 years or the next 10 years, but it is going to explode, and I think it's going to become more and more of an issue. And we always go on and on about how old people vote, and that's why they get better looked after by politicians, and we've got to turn that around. We've got to get young people back engaged, but for their own economic good. We've got to make sure, and that's something that I think the Labour Party have been looking at. One of the real visuals of this morning sessions at conference was Ian McNicol surrounded by 20 of the 100 appointed organisers, all really young people from up and down the country, getting out there and doing more sort of Labour organising in their communities. And that excites me, and that makes me think that we've got interested. And I think that visual backed up in many ways what the Lord Ashcroft poll was saying, is that we're working hard in those marginals. And if we can bring that energy from those young people into those seats and make it work for us, then I think we've got a much better chance than the front page of the Daily Mail might be giving us.
Okay. Well, I think we'll call it a day there. So I'd just like to thank all our guests today, Rob Marchant, Andy Harrop, Christine Quigley, and of course Emma Burnell. And so from Brighton, we bid you a farewell. I'd also like to thank the Bay Restaurant on the seafront in Brighton for allowing us to sit in a table in the corner. They probably don't quite understand what we're doing. I don't know if Emma's taking a picture of this that we could put up on the blog post, but we're kind of hidden behind a load of curtains, so it's quite curious. A curious environment.
It's a boudoir feel.
And I'd also like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back next week.